If you want to learn how to incorporate purpose, justice, and truth into your organization and become a transformational leader, listen to this next podcast.
Hello, brother, this is Jake Senzio, host of Jake and Gino Podcast with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, chef, the father, six, the best-selling author, Eddie. Gino Barbaro. Gino, how's it going?
Jake, to be honest, I'm doing phenomenal.
Honestly?
Yes. How are you doing, my friend?
Always making it happen, big man. Today's guest is an author, speaker, and entrepreneur. He is also the co-founder and managing partner of Navalent, an organization focused on helping CEOs and executives pursue transformational change for their organizations, leaders, and industries. Very excited about this one, Gino. So without further ado, Ron Carucci Gucci, welcome to the show.
Jake and Gino, my brothers, how are you? It's so good to be with you.
Very, very much our pleasure. And let's get to know each other a little better. We were bantering a little bit about the housing market before the show, but please share with us your background and how you got started in business.
Sure. Navalent is 18 years old. I founded it with two friends 18 years ago. And prior to that, had spent my career inside big companies as an industrial psychologist doing organizational leadership work. But I began my career inside large organizations and began to realize quickly that, well, I thought my job there was to help make things better, which required that you begin by being honest about where things are not better. I assumed that was my job. And I probably was too young to have the right kind of political savvy to know, how to be diplomatic about pointing those things out. So I began to collect up these really wonderful severance packages. And which my kids love because that meant more time with dad. And so in between big corporate jobs, I go out and consult. I'd sort of make a living and do some side gigs and consult. And it took me three times, before I realized that the same behavior that seemed to be problematic inside companies got me paid really well and respected outside companies. And so I thought I should probably take the hint. And if I'm going to live out my passion for organizations, it's probably going to have to be by not being part of one. And ancient wisdom says you can't be a prophet in your own land. I think Jesus was right. So I finally took the hint and went to but I wasn't really ready to go start my own thing. I was too young. And so I went to a really wonderful, wonderful niche boutique consulting firm in New York City. That was sort of if you arrived there, you had arrived in this field. That was the place to go. And spent 8 great years there. Learning what it means to be in the halls of a C-suite and sit across the desk from a CEO and have hard conversations. And then the founder of that firm sold it to a much bigger firm. And that stopped being fun. After a few years, it was just Feed the Dinosaur. And so that's when a couple of friends said, we can do this on our own. It's funny when you use the word entrepreneur, Jake. I'm like, am I really an entrepreneur? I guess technically, yes. But the most accidental one you ever met. We never said, let's go start a firm. We said, let's go do this on our own, absent the big firm, which we quickly realized that we're going to need help, which means we're going to have to hire people and we're going to have ways of doing things and they're going to have to be consistent. And we're like, we're building a firm. And that means we actually have to run it, which none of us really wanted to do. So we hired some people to run our business infrastructure, whatever, so we could at least focus on the work and the clients. But it was sort of been 18 years of accidental leadership of a firm. And it's been a great 18 years.
And Ron, you join a long list of unemployable Jake and Gino.
Yes.
I mean, like every week someone's saying I got fired. I got a severance package. I hated my job. I hated my boss. And it's just like, this is such a beautiful, I'm glad we actually are attracting these people because it seems like Jake and I are the same way.
So a couple of years ago, somebody approached us to want to buy the firm. We get offers all the time. People want to buy the firm. And so I'm on a Zoom call with this guy. He's the CEO of a mid-cap firm that wants to just plug and play us in. And I'm listening to him talk. He's there's a broker in the middle. He's asking all kinds of inappropriate questions that he shouldn't be asking. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, he would be your boss. That's what this would be.
You're signing me up for employment and I'm unemployable. I don't know how this deal works.
So we hung up the phone. My wife was listening in the background and she is cracking up, like tears in her eyes, laughing. And she's like, have you met you? She's like, what's going to happen the first time this guy says something like, hey, let's set your goals for next year. or your revenue for the third quarter is a little behind. What are we going to do about that? Or you're sitting in some cubicle farm and you get a call that says, hey, can you step in here for a minute? Like, how's that going to go? And I'm like, oh, she's so right. That would not go well at all. When I set my what? Didn't I mention that I don't do goals? Sorry, I should have told you. What do you mean step in there? You can come here.
Ron, you had talked about before we got on, we are in a trust recession. Now, we're going to jump into the book, to be honest and all. But I think we're in a trust depression. What do you mean by being in a trust recession?
If you look around by any measure, look at the Edelman Trust Barometer, look at all the data is telling us that people have lost trust in certainly in our media. That's not a big shock. Our government, not a big shock. But even in the private sector, the one place was the beacon of where people and the society at large expected their good things to be done. Even now in the private sector, we're losing trust in our institutions. If you have the title leader, people expect you to screw them. You used to be being a leader was revered, that you were respected because you were a leader. And then you had to lose the trust. Today, you start in the red. If you can go from being somebody's peer and drinking buddy and beloved, the minute you're elevated, suddenly you're, persona non grata and you have leprosy.
I blame it on tech. And I think people have tried to manipulate tech to persuade large swaths of people's opinion on things, and you get these keyboard warriors, and I think that's a huge component of it that's changed in the last 20 years. Think that's one thing that we're dealing with. That's a nuance to humans now.
Well, if you watch The Social Dilemma, and you should have, right?
I'm going to write it down right now.
It's all about how social media is and the algorithms that are shaping people's perceptions, and they want us angry, right? We know from the research that angry posts get 10 times the engagement as nice posts. We know that when you slam...
Same thing with the news.
Right. And people want fear bait and clickbait, right? Yeah. And so all people are doing all day, and the algorithms were designed to tell you what you want to hear. So, they pay very close attention to what you act upon, what you interact with, what you say. And so your feed is only filled with things you already believe, right? So the echo chambers around all of us are thickening. Mm-hmm. By default, naturally dividing us. We've long lost our ability for civil discourse. No longer can we simply have a friendly disagreement. It's now
I blame that on tech, because will not engage in a conversation with somebody, but if they're behind a keyboard in their basement, they will throw bombs and the most ridiculous, rude comments in the entire world. Where if you meet someone on the street, the chance of that happening is very slim. Not that it won't, but it's reduced greatly.
I'm looking at you in the eyes, a human being. I'm going to listen to you. I may not agree with you, but I'm going to be more respectful because I'm looking
at
it. But now we gave people weapons, right? We weaponized social media, and now it's a platform. We have confused speaking the truth with speaking your truth.
Yeah.
And people think it's the same
thing.
Well
said.
But the reality is we are having a lot of technological help being divided, right? And so now when I see, especially on social media, Jake, if you believe something different than me, politically, religiously, socially, morally, my immediate response is, to refute, convert, and to reject, and then convert you.
It's a cult.
It's immediately, I have to change you to cult save life. You from yourself.
Yeah.
No possibility that there's any flaws in my thinking.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Ron, though. Jake had shared something with me a couple of days ago. Do you think that a lot of people who are leaders should even be leaders? We're elevating people who have no skills, who have no quality to be a leader, you want equity and fairness. I totally get it. And there should be. But at the same point, when you have certain people elected office who are leading a really important branch of the government that can't get anything done and don't know how to lead and don't have the qualifications, that's the problem that we're facing right now. And corporations are getting into this. Before it was all about shareholder equity and trying to create money for a company, right? If you're public, if you're private, Ron and Gino can hang out in their basement, do whatever they want. It's our company. We want to lead our own companies. But when you're forward facing and you're a public company, you're trying to do ideology and not trying to maximize shareholder value. And you do that a lot of ways. First, you focus on the customers and then you focus on the employees and the shareholders will be rewarded. That's what you really should do if you want a company that's going to grow. Because if the if the customers are satisfied, then the employees will be satisfied, especially if you have a mission. If the employees are satisfied, you're going to maximize dollars and then you're going to really crank. I think right now, people who are leading, they don't know what the hell they're doing. You can't be a 36 or 37-year-old leading a massive entity of the government, and you have none. I'm not going to name any names, but I mean, you guys can probably—
You have no experience, you're saying, or real-world credibility to hold the position.
There's no qualifications to do the job. It's like, come on, bro. Give me a break. I mean, how are you going to lead?
So first of all, let's separate the private sector from the government, because these are two different worlds here, right? So you're not going to get the best talent in government, right? So you're already starting with a gene pool that's diluted. Mm-hmm. But secondly, even the non-political, the appointed agencies are politicized, right? And so Washington is now fractured like, a leg bone in a bad car accident. It's mm-hmm. completely splintered. And so even if you had talent to do the job, you're not going to— the bureaucracy levels, the restricted levels. I've got a couple of really big government agency clients. One of them is an agency that we all rely on a lot of protection from, and the people in that firm are some of the most brilliant, mission-driven, caring people I've ever met in my life. It's three letters and it starts with a C, and they're amazing. But the context in which they have to lead, the politicization of their protection mm-hmm. and their intelligence and their work is hijacked by idiots.
Yeah.
And so, but the people, I'm telling you, my private sector CEO clients would give a limb to have that level of passion. And people, by the way, who could be making 10 times more in the private sector are choosing service, right? But these people are frighteningly brilliant at what they do, but not the people who lead them. So it's a different animal in the private sector. The data is all clear, right? I combed the planet. I left no stone unturned. The companies that are being purpose-driven and stakeholder-driven, and not just customers and suppliers and employees, but communities in which they do business. The companies that are focused on all the stakeholders, not just the shareholders, are outperforming their competitive peers by wild margins, but on the S&P index by 500%, but in market share, brand loyalty, earnings per share, profitability, every metric you would care about. The companies that are genuinely doing it right and looking at all stakeholders in a very equal way, creating equitable environments in which people can thrive, where employees can do their best work, they're leaving their competitors. It's not even a small gap, right? So let's talk about boards. If boards of directors are not going to be, and I don't mean activist investors, those are idiots. I mean people who are there to govern the organization and provide thoughtful leadership over the enterprise. If they're not going to ask their CEO and their executive teams, how come you haven't pursued this? All the data says that this is the way competitors are winning and differentiating themselves. Why aren't we doing it? Do you think you're above that? If the boards are not going to assert themselves appropriately and ask the hard questions, then all the CEOs who are quarterly addicted to, first of all, look at WD-40, look at Best Buy, look at the companies that never provided quarterly guidance. And they told their investors, I'm not going to provide you quarterly guidance. And they're knocking it out of the park because they're really keeping that long-term.
It's a long-term mentality. But that's the same reason, going to our point before, was last year and the year before, investing was a challenge if you had a short-term mentality, if you needed to do the deal and you needed to place the money.
You're exposed. And so you said everybody sat on the cash, right? And then it started doing really stupid things with it, mm-hmm. Making really blind and uninformed choices. And that cash is still out there, but now people are now clinging to it and hoarding it mm-hmm. when they actually, this is the time to invest it.
That's exactly right.
Ron, I've got a bunch of notes here. I wrote down, let's get it to honesty. In the book, you say more honesty is the better we feel. It's a collective muscle. It's a team sport. And it's deeply connected to justice, purpose, and truth. Can you dissect that for us?
Yeah, sure. So the book is based on a 15-year study of 3,200 leaders. And we used some really cool, sophisticated AI technology. So we had, you know, 15 years of interviews that we'd done. And we let the AI, you know, algorithms actually study. And this technology is in the best possible way, it's creepy. Because it actually reads the information and makes meaning of it. And we wanted to, so we thought, wow, wouldn't it be cool if you could prove the conditions in which people make their best choices? You know, everybody wants to know, well, how did Wells Fargo happen? How did Volkswagen happen? How did Theranos happen? Which I actually find less interesting than, you know, how do the great stories happen? But what the data told us was that there were four conditions we could actually statistically and multiplicatively prove under what conditions people will tell the truth, behave fairly, and serve a greater good, and under what conditions they're going to lie, cheat, and serve their own interests first. And I thought, well, gosh, if you could actually prove that, could you prevent those dark stories from happening? And could you promote the stories that actually yield the better outcomes? But that wasn't what made us want to write the book. So we published the research, and that was it. But then people would come in and say, hey, can you take your research and screen the Theranos story for us or the college admission scandal? And I'm like, that's about as meaningful as a proctology exam. Why would I want to do that? I did a couple of them just to sort of prove the data. But I'm like, that is the most uninspiring, soul-sucking thing to look at. And then I got nervous. I'm like, could I have found four things that nobody's doing? Because that would suck. Is anybody living out the behaviors and the principles that we found? I wanted to know that. So I went looking, and suddenly they started coming out of the woodwork. Like, leaders and organizations are good-hearted, caring, committed, upright, talented, inspiring organizations and leaders doing all the things we'd found. And I'm like, that's the story I want to tell. That's the book to write. I want to write about the heroes, not the villains. So that's what we did. What we learned was that honesty is not a character trait. It's not the way our brains register honesty. It's a muscle. It's actually a capability, like talking or problem solving or presenting. It's a muscle in our brain that if you want to be good at it, you actually have to practice it. It's not just an intention. Most of us, if I say to leaders, do your people trust you? They're like, well, sure, why wouldn't they trust me? And I ask again, well, why would they? And what I get are a litany of answers that tell me that what you believe is trustworthy are your intentions, not your actual actions. And the notion that there could be a gap between your intent and your impact is not a leader's natural default mode. So when I tell leaders, you've lost the trust of your people, and here's why, they get perplexed and they get activated and they get defensive. And when I tell them, a client of mine, good guy, this is a good guy, not a jerk. I said, your team doesn't trust you. He said, how could that be? I'm straightforward with them. I advocate for them. I give them opportunities. I'm straight shooter with them. I said, But apparently when you're in meetings and somebody is sort of trying to express themselves not as crisply as you, you cut them off and you mock them sarcastically. And he said, well, everybody has a bad day. I said, you have a lot of them. And what you've told people is that you are not a safe place for them to not be perfect. Mm-hmm. And he would have never associated that behavior with not being trustworthy.
And he has awareness issues.
Well, clearly wasn't reading the room.
Here's the thing I want to touch on this real quick. And I think one of the most interesting things is that as CEOs, leaders, whatever you want to call these people, they're visionaries. So they see the company as they want it, and they're seeing it through their lens, and they're seeing it through their vision. But there's a gap between the vision and what they want and the reality of what the company is. And I think that gap is where these people are failing. So they intend to be honest. They intend to be this. Their actions don't always back it up. And then the true facts of what the organization is, that's the gap where these people are failing. Is that fair to say?
I think it's a great observation, Jake. And the problem is it starts like this.
Yeah.
But when there's no calibration that can close that gap, then you do this.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And it's not just it's whole leadership teams, right? The entire enterprise level leadership gets bubbled in and insulated from the truth. And if you've not created spaces where people can tell you what you want to hear, tell you what you need to hear, I tell leaders all the time, this is a very, very simple metric. If you don't have somebody coming into your office once or twice a week telling you something that makes you uncomfortable, you can be very confident your leadership sucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they're afraid to speak to you. And then these executive teams live in their little bubble and they're like, well, I told the people to do it like this. Well, is it actually happening? Did you ensure that these things are getting pulled through?
Did you test and measure?
That's right.
And actually have the ability or the time or the resources, or did you forget about the
Is it even capable? Yeah, it's great to be able to say it and snap your fingers, but is the shit really happening?
And did you also forget about the 10 things you told them to do last week?
Exactly right.
If they're still working on it. Or they're working on the ones from a month ago. Yeah. Or did you bother to conclude the fact that the thing you just told them to do this week completely contradicts the thing you told them to do last week? Nope. So they're just doling out yeses. Because they're.
But it's easy to sit on your throne and point the finger and say, "Do this, do this, do this." But the money is made if you're able to do that, and then monitor and help the implementation actually take place and see it through. This is the gap we're talking about.
Not doing the job for them, but to make sure that they're resourced, capable, and equipped, and clear on what it is you've asked them to do. But so many, you know, here's one of the always telling signs of an organization that's, you know, broken. Is when you go around the executive team and you say, so what's your strategy? And I don't want to hear the mission, the values, and I don't want to hear the platitudes. I want to hear how you compete, what differentiates you, what your priorities are, what you're focused on. And I go around, I get 10 different answers. Mm-hmm. Like some of them wildly different. I'm like, okay, so let's break
this
down.
This has been for the last, I would say, eight, maybe, I don't know. I'll say 3/4 minimum. Our team's priority is making sure that the entire team is aligned on what the strategy is and that they can articulate it. And the reason is that we were very clear as an executive team to a certain extent. Now the executive team is very clear, but making sure the entire team is clear and then not. And one of the huge mistakes that we've made in the past is that here are your quarterly priorities. And then we'll set new quarterly priorities before even ensuring the existing ones were implemented and they actually stuck.
Right.
So now we're just shutting it down, meaning that until this shit is actually working, implemented, and adopted, and we really believe that, and the same reason why we haven't moved off that initiative of making sure that everyone's on the same page, is that shit takes time. And you know what? You're pissed and it didn't happen the way you wanted it to. But until it's adopted and it's really taking place, we're not going to move on to something else because then we're just chasing our tails and wasting our time.
And companies do that all the time, Jake. Yeah. They have short-term memories and it's the sort of the sexy, especially if you have
new initiative, new initiative, new initiative.
Write a new book.
Yeah. Yeah. I read a book. Yeah, here was what we're doing now because this is what Jeff Bezos did yesterday, right?
But guys, I want to play devil's advocate here for a second. I understand everything you're saying, but it can be tough on leaders because we have to perform, we have to be creative, we have to be visionary, we have to try to make it happen for the company. And sometimes we take on more than we're supposed to, and sometimes we don't have, I guess, the bandwidth. So I think as leaders, we need to pull back and be aware that we're not doing that. And that's why we started doing quarterly priorities a few years ago. So if you're a leader out there who's struggling, be honest with yourself and say, am I doing the stuff that
Jake's I'm not picking on people now? To Gino's point, I've been there and made these mistakes and I'm speaking from experience.
And I'm
like,
still making those mistakes. Yeah, so that's why I'm listening to you 100%. Going, okay, that's a little bit of me. My emotional intelligence is pretty high, but when it comes to certain things, I see the vision. I see things clearly.
I was talking about Gino, by the way, I was speaking for myself, not you. Like, ooh, that was 100% of me.
Do we have intervention here? This is good. Yeah.
Well, Jake and Gino is the same thing. We're just the same person splitting.
No,
half.
But so I was speaking for my own faults. Yeah, like that shit was all on me, no one else.
Could do a little marriage counseling here.
Jake doesn't like to share his emotions. Jake's a snowplower. Yeah. I'm the more get to know you a little bit, think out for sure, go on. He's like, I'm gonna snowplow right through. But it's interesting because even though I do want to hear, and sometimes, Ron, I've got 6 kids. Didn't know if you knew that. And to have a large family and to have a lot of kids, you really need to spend time and listen to them. And that is tiring. It's daunting sometimes. And as a leader, you need to, as you written the book, you want to be able to walk in their shoes, be empathetic. And sometimes it's really tiring and it's really exhausting to do that. You've got so much other work to do. You've got to make money for the quarter. You've got payroll. But at the same time, it's more important to do a quarterly priority with your employees. Sit down and make sure they're heard. I've had some great quarterly priorities the last couple of weeks of our reviews. Sit down and listen to your employees. Sometimes, you know, disconnect, and it's really hard. And Jake, thanks for the intervention, by the way, because now I'm reflecting. I'm like, okay, I've screwed up this last quarter, but I also did a couple of good things that I'm proud of. And what can I do better for next quarter? And I think it's constant improvement. I think it's being honest with yourself as well to say I've done great, but there's a lot of things that I can get better.
Gino, it's being honest with them, right? It's letting them know you screwed up and apologizing and saying, hey, I overcommitted, or I overestimated, or I wasn't kind to you. Leaders, you know, your a leader's weaknesses, a leader's imperfections are their greatest source of credibility, not the things you're good at. Most leaders think they're supposed to be the answer ATM. And that's not what we need. We need you to be human, fully human. And we need you to own your weaknesses before somebody has to tell you, or be sure they're telling each other, right? Every night at the dinner table of your employees, they're telling stories about you. Every night,
I didn't realize that was this popular.
Well, the question that Jake is, do you know what stories they're telling?
No, but I'm still, it puts me like up on the popular meter. Like I'm on, like, hey, we're getting attention. That's a good thing, right? Let's just make sure.
Unless they're telling the stories that start with that fucking, boss of mine.
That fucker.
You know,
God, he's driving me nuts.
Yeah, but then, you know what, Jake, listen to the story and maybe that fucker can change his attitude if he does something wrong and say, oh, wow, what did I do wrong? And then obviously you can change it.
So I think Gino's lobbying for spy cameras at the dinner table of our team members so we can listen and hear what they're doing. And then we can come back in and be like, so.
Damn, you're really good. How'd you get all that from what I just said? Boy, we really are on the same wavelength. I have
a feeling that you're thinking this.
Yeah.
Ron,
you know what? You should know those stories. You should absolutely be able to predict what those stories are.
Before we go to the personal development questions, there's four factors you wrote that affect honesty. Let's hit those really quick. I'll let everyone listen to them, write them down, absorb them. It's identity, accountability, governance, and Jake, cross-functional relationships. I don't even know what the heck that means, but we'll find out what that means.
Not touching
that. Let's start there, because each one of those multiply. So, sales and marketing, supply chain operations, you know, finance and R&D, all the places where there are natural tensions in your organization, those are seams. And when those seams are not stitched, when there is rivalry there that's unresolved, you are 6 times more likely to have people be dishonest. Because once you fragment the organization, you fracture the truth. And when we have dueling truths, it's no longer about a single source of truth. It's about my truth versus your truth.
You know, winning.
And what I know about my truth is that I'm right and you're wrong. And now that's what the conversation becomes. 6 times. Transparency, right? So when I walk into a room in an organization, often called a meeting, and the people around the table are having an exchange of information, if I believe that conversation is a fully transparent conversation, everybody is honest, the person in the front of the room doesn't have an agenda about what they're presenting. They're presenting me a balanced look at whatever their ideas or reports are. And if I wanted to offer a point of view that was different than the prevailing one in the room, I'd be free to do that. When that's the case, you're 3.5 times more likely to have people be dishonest. I'm sorry, be honest. But if I walk into that room and it's nothing more than orchestrated theater where the decision was made.
And we've all been there, right? We've been in those fucking meetings.
The decision was made yesterday. The goal is to make it look like everybody in the room made it today. the person in the front of the room clearly is spinning the information. And the last thing I think you want to hear from me is a point of view that is different than yours. Now you're 3.5 times more likely to have people be dishonest and lie to you because the truth has to be found outside the room.
Yeah, it's all fabricated.
It's just performance art. Accountability. If the way if I believe the way my work and my contribution are talked about are fair, meaning I can show up here and be as successful as anybody else here, and with dignity, meaning I feel like my work is being honored here. Remember, in today's workplace, there's no longer a difference between the work and the worker, right? My remit is no longer how many cases I closed, how many files I processed. My remit is my ideas, my insights, my point of view, my perspective, my solutions. It's a part of who I am. And if I feel like the way you're talking about my work and talking about me is honoring, you're 4 times more likely to have people be honest and tell you the truth and behave fairly. But if I feel like a cog in your wheel, if I feel like the system is rigged, that there's favorites and non-favorites, and I can't be successful because I don't look or sound like him or her, now you're 4.5 times more likely to have me lie because I have to hide my mistakes and embellish what I did to get your attention.
That sounds like the government.
It sounds like a lot of companies too.
Yeah.
And lastly was be who your clarity and your identity. Are you who you say you are? So we all have things on the wall, missions, brand promises, purpose statements, values. Turns out that if the words you say and the actions you produce match, you're three times more likely to have people be honest. But if the words on the wall contradict how people act in your company, you've now told the company duplicity is okay here. Around here, we say one thing and do another. And so that's perfectly okay. Now you're three times more likely to have people lie because you told them it's okay. If you do all four of those things well, you are 16 times more likely to have, because they're cumulative. That's how we did the modeling. It's cumulative. You're 16 times more likely to have people be honest with you and tell each other the truth and tell you the truth. But if you suck at all four of those things, you're 16 times more likely to have yourself end up in a headline story of a newspaper you never wanted to be in.
Jake, before we go to the short answers, I want to share a big shout out to, I think, our team about the cross-functional relationships. Our sales team, Scott and Dylan, and our onboarding fulfillment team, Mackenzie. So the sales team is there. Their main goal is to actually get people across the finish line, join the mentorship program. Mackenzie's there to actually onboard and start the fulfillment. And that cross-functional relationship is really good because our sales team is not like, okay, on to the next lead. It's such a great handoff, and it's such a great way. And our sales team is really bought into the fact that they want the students to succeed. They've worked on it. You know, they've spent hours on these phone calls, getting their blueprints, getting all their goal setting. And then when they give it off to Mackenzie, so she onboards them and actually gets them into the Jake and Gino community, there's that great relationship amongst the two. It's not confrontational. It really is a great relationship. And I think that's part of our success with our students. And I think our students feel that, and they see Dylan at these events because he's a salesperson. He's a senior advisor. He doesn't need to come to our fulfillment events, but he's there because he cares about the students and he cares about their success. And I think he understands that, hey, more successful students, more referrals, more business, much better place to live, much happier place to live. So, you know, as you're listening to this, everybody, that's really, really important. I think that's something that we didn't strive upon early on, but we're like, okay, it's not sell, on to the next one. It's sell, take care, then on to the next one, but continue to take care, go back and forth. So big shout out to Dylan and Mackenzie.
Ron, I learned a few weeks ago of this term corporatocracy. And when you said it sounds like a lot of businesses as well, I think it's these large entities becoming one and mimicking themselves like the federal government coming together. And I think that's where you're seeing this as well. It's very interesting. I'll just go back. This is the big aha moment that I had. I worked in the pharmaceutical industry back in the day, and it was evil pharma, bad pharma, this, that, and the other thing. And now it's merged into this like government entity, and especially around like 2010 during the Sunshine Act, and it's changed quite a bit where now it's like held up as this, you know, not to all, but it's different from the same people that I heard that from back in the day. So it's interesting to see how these things have changed over time too. And I wonder if that's a component of it.
So I have a lot of biopharma clients.
Yeah.
The clients that I work with, they're not, you know, are amazing. These people are passionate about their patients. They're passionate about their medicines. They're passionate about what they're going to do. I don't know that it's just big clients. I see a lot of startups with the same
thing. Yeah.
But here's why, because they're like the teenage boy in their dad's suit, right? They grew, but they didn't scale. Right. And so it's mayhem. You walk in, you see people running around like chickens without their heads, and you see the founding entrepreneurs say, look at this energy. It's so great. I'm like, no, you're driving them crazy.
They're scared to death.
because your revenues outpace your scale.
Yeah.
And
your infrastructure isn't there to support it. Yeah.
And so, you know, you're like the teenage boy in his dad's suit, didn't grow into the suit yet. And you have to do the work to scale.
They got out over their skis, for sure.
Way over their skis. Yeah. And they let it go on too long. And so now people are suffering. And so now you have to catch up. And, you know, what's the word entrepreneurs hate to say? No. But you have to say no to things. Until you can tell me what you're saying no to, you have no strategy.
Yep.
And so then suddenly you're the $100 million company trapped in the body of a $30 million organization.
Yep.
And you don't want to wake up to that. And so your capacity for
that's mayhem. Yes.
Right. And your capacity to deny that mayhem is quite sophisticated, and nobody wants to tell you the truth. So
I've lived this, by the way, to a certain extent. And we're going to hold it right here and pick this up just after the commercial break. So, gang, let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor. A question, Gino, and I get a lot is, what's a great value add?
You've just closed a deal and you're looking for a way to maximize the attractiveness of your complex to potential renters.
At RAND Property Management, we start at the bottom. Literally, we start with the flooring.
And that means we start with a call to Christian Chapman and his team at David's Abbey Carpet and Flooring. No one wants to deal with the expense and hassle of putting in new floors, and that is exactly why we turn to David's Abbey.
David's Abbey Carpet and Flooring provides a quality, long-lasting product at a great price. The wear layer and waterproofing that comes standard with all David Abbey products will ensure you are on solid ground for years to come.
My favorite part of working with Christian and his team is convenience. David's Abbey will direct ship their product anywhere in the U.S. That's white glove service, folks.
And your installation team will love how easy it is to install. The next time that you're looking for a great value add, give our friends at David's Abbey Carpet and Flooring a call and speak with Christian.
Or click the link in the show notes to visit their website today.
All right, we're back. We're gonna pick it up on this this scale comment that he made just a second ago. I want to hear from you as your firm has evolved. Talk about some of the growing pains and how you scaled and some of the best practices, because we, you know, in a very short period of time, went from owning a single 25 unit apartment community to, you know, purchasing 1900 apartments. And that's been our evolution and growth. And the business looks a lot different, you know, at 25 units than it does at, you know, over 1500. And there was a time there where we were expanding, we were going out into new geographies and that growth was painful. So we've lived that. And I know exactly what you're talking about. So I'd love to hear some pain points that you had during your evolution scale and maybe some best practices for folks as they're scaling their companies as well.
Well, so the sooner you can grow into the grown-up organization, the better. Right. I'd rather have people at that rapid, so like a baby's mitosis, right? The cells divide. At an early stage venture, your work is dividing rapidly, right? And so organization design is the one competitive differentiator you actually have, how you configure the assets of your organization. And if you're not thinking about there's three types of work in every company. There's competitive work. This is about 15% of the work you do. And it's if you invest $1 in that work, $5 comes in the door. There's enabling work. This is the work that directly supports competitive work processes. So if you're competing on service, right, that's anything that touches customers, that serves them, is competitive work. That means your customer analytics is enabling work, right? That's another 15% of, or maybe 20% of your work. The other 50 to 60% of your work is necessary work. Keeps the lights on, keeps you out of jail. No one's going to pay you more money to do it better than anybody else. So you have to do it at parity. What happens is, as you grow quickly, all that work gets mixed up. And if you don't protect your competitive work and the work that supports it, it gets diluted because the necessary work is more time constrained. And so that's what people are going to scream about. That's what they're going to do. And your ability to compete gets, without you even realizing it, gets impaired. So how you design the work of your organization and the people, and you have to invest for maximum impact and effectiveness in competitive and enabling work. Spend the most money on talent, give it the most resources. All your necessary work is for maximum efficiency. Do it as cheaply and repetitively as possible. It's all your back office stuff that supports your work. And you have to start building in that repeatability and building in those processes and designs that allow for that scalability. Scalability means you're making more money at a faster rate than you're spending it. Right? Growth is, it's coming in, it's going out. And so if you don't design your organization to scale at an early place, but entrepreneurs hear the word standardization and they have an out, they break out in a rash.
Well, and you said accidental entrepreneur, referring to yourself before. So if you're an accidental entrepreneur, you may not have any awareness that this shit is coming and it's coming quick.
Here's the problem. I mean, even though it's true in every company, there's always a cobbler's kids have no shoes. Like, my guess is that if I looked at your apartment, it probably is not, you're not taking care of your apartment the way you care of other people's apartments, right? So the change management firm of transformation, you know, didn't always do change management well ourselves. Mm-hmm. But we do know how to separate the work. We do know how to protect it. And we actually did do a really good job early on of building a brand framework, of building what's expected of how do we intend to be successful. And we stuck to it. And we built out processes that were very repeatable. When we hired a CFO like 2 years into our firm, smartest thing we ever did. I think it was more just to relieve our own pain of having to do shit we didn't want to do. But now 18 years later that we're sort of reflecting on the 18 years of impact we've had, one of the things we realized was that with the fact that we had other people doing work that we shouldn't be doing, enabled us to become really, really good at what we do by focusing only on our clients and the work we do for them. Whereas other boutique firms, it's everybody's a jack of all trade and doing it all. And we were very privileged not to have to do that, but because we had people focused on doing all the things that keep a firm running. And we probably should have been a lot more grateful for that a lot sooner.
You discussed being unemployable, and that was fun. What was the aha moment? Do you have a story when you realized that, wow, I really cannot be an employee?
Which severance package was it?
Yeah. So it took a few at bats there.
One of them was voluntary. Two of them were not. And there were a lot of them were political. I think it was a cumulative realization that I think it was more the good side of when I behaved the exact same way as someone outside a company. All of a sudden, I was getting respected, and people expected me to be, you know, forthright and candid. And I'm like, why? I'm the same person. Why all of a sudden like it's now
Twilight Zone right now?
Yeah. But I think it was more the realization that it worked well outside the company than the blind spots I had inside companies where I would just sort of blurt out what I needed to be said, and sometimes I didn't blurt well. You know, I was sort of like cocky and a little bit sharp elbows.
It's an arrogance.
And it's
a nice guy, but you're arrogant. There we go.
I was naive. Yeah. And I believe more in what they told me they wanted than I actually should have. But I do remember, you know, I was working in one inside the company for one large department. It was a technology group inside a technology company. So that was risky. Head of his department was known like he was like mafia, like just evil. And so we collected a bunch of data from the organization and it was not good. And I'm presenting this data back, and he was sitting in the back of the room, and it's, you know, at the aggregate level, all these bar graphs are, you know, look pretty much at the same level, but the integrity had a little bit of a dip in it. But if you broke that down by different groups, it was even worse. So he had planted a woman in the front of the room, PhD data scientist kind of type, to sort of discredit me. So she, you know, I'm presenting the data, I'm nervous. I know people in the room are scared that now we're not telling them what they told us anonymously. And so she stands up and she says, "How do we know this data is even reliable? Did you do a validity test? Was there any reliability? Do these statistics really correlate?" You know, and just scientifically trying to dismantle the credibility of the data. And I let her do it. I said, "You know, let me answer the questions you asked. Was a t-test done on the reliability of this thing? It's at 0.83. The correlations were very high. The sample items were all tested for validity. And so the data is telling us what it tells us. But you know what? Let's not take my word for that." And the whole group, and I said, "Tell me, by a show of hands, how many of you in this room have never lied to someone else in this room?" No hands went up.
Crickets.
And so I looked at her, I said, "I think we all know what the data is telling us.
Drop the mic. I'm out this."
And several weeks later, that severance package arrived. I probably could have handled that differently.
No, screw that, dude. You nailed it.
But I also set her up, right? I set her up. I could have been a little bit more. I know she was a plant. I know she was put up to it. I don't think she
basically participated in something that was probably not the most ethical either. So screw her.
She colluded, right? Yeah. And so I in hindsight, I told that story as if look at me. But today I liked it.
I thought it was great.
I would do that differently. I would actually probably say something like,
"Don't lose your edge, man, dude. Come on."
Well, the edge could have come out differently. I could have said something like, "I'm so sorry you were put up to this. I'm so sorry that you've been asked to stand up and actually have to discredit someone you know is credible. But let me answer your question so you can check the box that you did what you're supposed to do." And then did the hand raise question. But at least let her off the hook, right?
Nah, you gotta let her sit in it for you know, going along with something she knew was wrong. So
so now as an outsider, I'm a hero for doing that, right? Go figure.
Yeah, total hero. Love it. All right. So we were jokingly picking on books earlier, but we know that education is important. You can get great ideas from reading. Anything that you've read in the last, you know, couple of years that has added value to your life that you want to share with the folks?
Yeah. Well, right now, this book, Arthur Brooks's From Strength to Strength,
Great cover.
Painful book, but beautiful book. I mean, really looks like, you know, the realities of professional decline and why things change and why we lose our edge and how to make the back half of your life more meaningful than, you know, listen, all three of us are in a peer group of the most depressed people in the world. White men in our peer group are the most depressed, the most suicidal, the most feeling the least meaning in life. That was all foreseeable. So
what is the data say on that, and why? Why is that the case?
Because we were married to our work, because we became, our identities became the accumulation of wealth, the accumulation of stuff, the accumulation of trophies of whatever kind. And you just can't accumulate those trophies at the same rate after 30, 40 years old. Most of us don't want to believe that professional decline happens much sooner than we think it does. Our brains, our bodies, you know, it's obvious with athletes. But if you, one of the interesting surveys he quotes is, most people asked, when does old age start? And the average age people picked was 8 years after most people die. So we're all thinking this goes on a little bit longer than it actually does. So,
you're saying like 60 is the cap for the next president then?
I wish it were lower than that. that gene pool's really in a dangerous place. So I think most of us are not prepared for the fact that we have to make transitions in our careers to look at different ways of having meaning in life and enjoying what we've done, but enjoying living a life that's different than we live professionally. And most people are not ready for that. I was certainly not ready for that. That's why I read the book. Hey. The other book I would recommend that I think should be required reading for the whole planet is David White's book, Crossing the Unknown Sea. The subtitle is Work as a Pilgrimage of Life. It's all about our relationship to work and who we are in the world. Those are a couple.
Cool. No, I appreciate that. And where can we get the book again? Is it do you have a website or is it Amazon? What's the best place?
Amazon's a great place. But if you want to learn more about the book, so one of the things we did was I videoed all the interviews with the heroes I talked to.
Oh, wonderful.
Most of them. So we did a TV show. We have a news magazine show called Moments of Truth. It's on Roku. Or you can go to the website tobehonest.net and you can find a webinar series about the book. You can find all 15 episodes. You can binge watch on a weekend of Moments of Truth. You meet some phenomenal people and hear all the stories that I couldn't put in the book. Or get it on Amazon. It's great too. If you want to learn more about our work as a firm, Navalent, NAVALENT.com. Great place to learn. Am I boring you, Gina?
No, I'm stretching. I'm getting ready for my preza. I gotta sing for you, Ron. The name like Ron Carucci. I'm gonna throw a little opera here. So I'm getting warmed up for your.
This is like Tony Robbins doing push-ups. You don't even know it's coming yet, Ron. So just, you know, he's not dissing you. He's literally getting jacked up because he's going to serenade you. But I would like to see the book. Gino, you got the book again? You want to hold it up?
I do have the book again, Jake.
To be honest, Gino, you did look a little bored, but I understand you well enough now that you were just gearing up. So Gino, take away, sir.
Well, I'm going to challenge Ron by saying we need to achieve excellence. And I think that we need to strive as our age group, what does excellence look like to us? What does success look like to us? And it's changed for me. First, it was dollar signs. Now, for me, becoming a coach, becoming a mentor to younger people, putting out this type of content, all of a sudden, I'm going to try to strive for excellence every single year. I want to become that alpha male. And I'm learning other things that I never did before. And, you know, from becoming an industrial psychologist, don't even know what the hell that means, right? Sucking at his job because he thought, hey, I'm going in here. I'm telling people the truth when they don't really want to know the truth. So let me leave that. Let me get fired purposely, I think once, but get in the boot twice. And then his kids are like, Pops, you're home again? Pops, maybe you should reconsider this like 9-to-5 kind of gig. Maybe you should do your own thing. And you're like, you know what? The third time's the charm. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start my own gig, but I'm not really an entrepreneur. So let me go out there and let me get people do what they like to do, what they're good at. And I'm going to build the machine and I'm going to do really, truly, I guess, do what I love to do. And, you know, over 18 years, I mean, that's pretty amazing. And for me, it's difficult being a leader. And I think go back and listen to this, to the episode. I would absolutely read the book because the book has got a lot of information that we weren't able to touch on. I guess one other big point, I want to personally thank Ron. I needed this intervention with Jake today. It's a great way to start the new year. We're able to work on our issues a little bit today live. And
oh, dude, get me out of here.
You see what I'm saying, Ron? It was worth it. Just send the bill to Jake at jakeandgina.com, and Jake will definitely pay you for the bill. And for the serenade, Che bella cosa, una giornata in sole, un'aria serena dopo una tempesta, e l'aria fresca pare già una festa. Che bella cosa, una giornata in sole. You didn't let me warm up, Ron, as much. I would have really ripped it, but I hope you enjoyed it. From one paisan to another.
I love it. Guys, have a great new year. Be kind to each other. Be better listeners to each other. Be patient with each other. Kiss and make up when you have to.
Did you hear that, Jake?
I typically sign off, but Ron's taking the reins today. Guys, we'll see you next time. Thank you so much.
Cheers, guys.